Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Tomas Yonaski, top international governance authority, founding head of the United Nations University Operating Unit on Policy-Driven Electronic Governance. Tomas, you just have a remarkable success story of accomplishment, and I know the audience will really appreciate all the insights you can share with them.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for the invitation.
Again, because of your remarkable history, from your early years up to the present, can you share a few notable events leading to your current roles and maybe some lessons you've learned from your success?
I wonder whether my recalling the past has any boundaries. Yes, I would probably go as early as 82, when I shifted my university study from machine building to applied mathematics. So that was probably the first major notable event that shaped my subsequent professional career. 10 years later, in 91, I was lucky to earn a doctoral scholarship for East European countries at the University of Warwick to study computer science there. In 95, I got a job at United Nations University Institute in Macau, which I departed in 2002 and returned back in 2004. And from then onwards, I was engaged with electronic governance. So the more recently, the challenge of taking up the position I'm holding right now, so building a new research policy and leadership education institution under the United Nations University System in Portugal, these were the major events that shaped my professional career. Concerning the second part of your question, lessons to learn from this, I guess the main lesson is openness to change happening around. So we are not the hostages of our background or education, and it's important to continue adapting and learning. Although your roots, your professional roots, will not allow you to forget about them, so somehow they will influence the way you act in various future professional roles. And the second lesson is investment in people. So at some stage, it's not what you achieve yourself, but how you're able to grow people around you that matters more.
So those are some excellent lessons to share, and just a remarkable history, as I mentioned earlier. So thank you for that. Now, from your work with the United Nations and so on, what led you to the founding of the United Nations University Operating Unit on Policy-Driven Electronic Governance?
Well, we have been engaged with electronic governance research and policy and education since 2004, and we experience continuing and growing demand in these areas for research, training, advisory services. More and more this demand is created on the subnational level. So not only national agencies responsible for ICT and e-government development, but also state governments and city-level governments are interested in advancing in this area. The creation of UNU eGov, as we call the Operating Unit on Policy-Driven Electronic Governance, is directly related to this demand. But of course, this is not a sufficient condition. The second condition for the establishment of the unit was the transformation of the institute in Macau from more technical to more social mandate, and the electronic government program finding its own home in Portugal. And finally, of course, the willingness of the Portuguese government and our local host, University of Minho, to invest in the topic and UNU presence in the country. has any United Nations University institute or entity the presence requires host country agreement and provision of local funding. So there are a number of conditions that have to be fulfilled in addition to substantive issues, also institutional, legal, and financial issues.
You know, that's fascinating. So can you delve even deeper into the purpose and your specific measurable goals for the organization?
The organization is part of the United Nations system, so it's fully aware and aligned with some of the important policy level discussions taking place within the UN system, particularly on the post-2015 United Nations Development Agenda. As you know, the Millennium Development Goals Program is officially ending this year, and there is an ongoing discussion on what will replace it. So in line with this discussion, there is clearly a recognition of the role of technology and the importance of governance for development. These are two elements that were not explicitly recognized in the MDG framework. So our purpose is to support the UN system and UN member states in transforming the mechanisms of governance. So this includes the working of government and in building effective governance capabilities at the local, national, and international levels through digital technology. So we look at how these enhanced governance capabilities, public governance capabilities, can help to pursue more effectively public policy and sustainable development objectives in different contexts. So also, unlike the Millennium Development Framework that was not context-specific, the post-2015 UN Development Agenda is very aware that the local and national contexts are very important for the outcome of any development initiatives, and the adaptation to local context should always take place. So in order to pursue this transformation of governance capabilities and mechanisms of governance through digital technology, we engage in research. This is not basic research, this is policy relevant research, in transfer of research results to policy, and in building capacity within our partner organizations in the use of policy instruments, and building network capacity of electronic government research and policy communities to share experience and knowledge in the area. So one observation from a few years back is that research and policy have been, and the corresponding communities have been developing quite separately and independently, with lack of, difficulty to bridge these two areas. So we explicitly seek to bridge research and policy so that one can benefit from another.
You know, I can definitely see the sort of the underlying government sort of benefits of this and the linkages with government. Do you see any benefits to industry, the broader industry, in terms of the work that you're doing?
Most of the innovations that are picked up by government are coming from the private sector. Private sector is, of course, much faster in terms of adopting the digital innovations and responding to digitally savvy customers. So government certainly follows the private sector. Well, government, of course, private sector has a key interest in what is happening with the public sector ICT because of the regulatory and policy-making role of government, and the fact that the public sector is one of the biggest customers and of information technology. So I would say that in the past, most of the innovation was coming one way, from the private to the public sector. It's probably the case still today, although there is a strong trend in engaging citizens in co-production of public services, and this certainly brings a lot of innovation to the public sector as well. So in terms of technology performance, still, of course, the private sector leads in terms of structural improvements in terms of technology management, certainly yes, but the many of the developments, technology developments in the public sector can be also watched very closely in the private sector. And of course, another trend is that more and more public activities and public sector activities and public services are delivered by the private sector. So as government is not in the technology business, the outsourcing of specialized technological capabilities and the development of software is basically not performed by government but by the private sector. So I would say sectoral issues are important, but we very often crossing sectoral boundaries with the technology and with the technology-enabled innovation.
So that's very good. I mean, a significant portion of my audience is from the private sector, so they'd be fascinated by that response. Now, what is the purpose and the sort of specific measurable time-bound, what I call SMART goals, of the International Conference on Theory and Practice of Electronic Governance?
Yeah, thank you for asking about ISGOV. ISGOV is a truly global forum where electronic government research policy and experience can be shared and discussed across and above any national, thematic, sectorial or development borders. This is a conference that we established in 2007. It has gone through 8 editions, starting in Macau, then moving to Cairo, Bogota in Colombia, then Beijing, then Tallinn in Estonia, Albany, New York, Seoul, Korea, and Guimarães last year. And altogether, we brought 102 countries as part of the conference. The goal of every edition of ISGOV conference is to bring together the leading thinkers, policymakers, and innovators to discuss ways forward with technology-enabled governance, which is not just, as we just discussed, which is not just the business of the public sector, because all sectors are involved in technology-enabled governance. Specific goals for every conference, as you ask for them, we aim at least 150 submitted research and experience papers. So ISGOV is a research and policy conference, so it does have a formal process of submitting papers, reviewing them, and then accepting. We aim at a rigorous process of reviewing these research papers. We have at least normally 3 independent reviews per paper. We aim at less than 30% full paper acceptance ratio, so we accept 1 out of 3 full papers. And we normally have at least 300 participants from at least 50 countries. These are measurable targets that we do try to maintain. Right now, the most and of course, the long-term purpose is to maintain and to grow the community. So we have close to 2,000 authors from 102 countries that have been submitting their papers for the conference and attending and presenting and interacting with colleagues, with the peers from government, from the private sector. It's also interested to for us to see that when publishing, of course, is a traditional and expected activity in academia, we do see a growing number of submissions from government and from international organizations. So, And right now, for us, the most specific goal moving forward is to find alternative for ISGov 2015, which was planned for Tunis. So given the security situation and recent attacks, we had to cancel this conference, and we are currently consulting our community for the way forward, whether we should move the conference to a few months later in spring to an alternative location, to host the conference, hold it digitally as a virtual conference electronically, or perhaps cancel the conference but still run the electronic proceedings.
So what kind of lead time do you normally have then? So for example, your indication of moving or delaying the conference, what kind of lead times do you need?
Usually it's really like a around-the-clock activity. I was not aware of the amount of work that one has to devote to prepare a world-quality conference. This is a massive institutional effort, and really as it has to, as soon as we finish one conference, we already have announcement for the second conference. We already start inviting program committee members, calling for papers, and accepting and reviewing them. So it's really like a 12-month lead time in terms of preparation, and I would say at least 18-month lead time in terms of deciding on the future locations of the conference.
Now, can you provide an overview of the lessons from some of the top articles with Government Information Quarterly?
Thank you for this question. GIQ is currently the leading journal in the area of information technology policy and governance. I have the honor of being one of co-editors-in-chief. My colleague Marijn Jansen from Technical University of Delft from the Netherlands is another co-editor in chief. I mean, thinking about the type of articles I could talk about, the most frequently cited article is the one that concerns the culture of transparency using information technology. This is an article from 2010. And it specifically refers to the use of e-government and social media as a tool for openness and anti-corruption. The article is by John Berthaud, Paul Jager, and Justin Grimes. So it looks at digital technology as cost-effective means of promoting transparency and reduce corruption, and addresses a critical question whether e-government has a potential to create a social change in, or cultural change in, attitudes toward transparency. So cultural attitudes about transparency. So the conclusion is not so definite, because the extent to which technology can create a culture of transparency is unclear, but there is indication to show that technology can in fact create an atmosphere of openness that can identify corrupt behavior. So that's one article that I think is worth referring to. Another article refers to the government use of social media. This is a 2012 article by John Berthaud and Paul Jager and Derek Hansen. And examines basically how government organizations are interacting with citizens through social media. And for the first time, it actually identifies that social media use by government raises significant legal and policy issues concerning privacy, security, data management, accessibility, social inclusion, and other. And that the way government has been enthusiastically adopting social media use, the speed of this outpaced the development of the regulatory framework. So there is a lot of work that still has to be done on regulations, at least according to this article in 2012. And maybe the last article that I would like to refer to is actually still in press. It's to appear in the July issue, so this month issue of GIQ, is about political determinants of e-government performance, comparing democracies and autocracies by Sebastian Stier. Basically, the paper examines the performance of countries in e-government, considering the political system in these countries, whether it's democratic or non-democratic, and the capacity of government, whether we talk about high capacity or low capacity government. And the main finding is kind of surprising, is that the autocratic countries are catching up with democratic countries concerning e-government performance. So non-democratic countries are increasingly using public sector technology to enhance performance, economic performance in particular, and in this way enhance their or support their legitimacy. So the initial advantage of democratic countries with the free flow of knowledge and innovation and deliberative institutions have gave way to non-democratic countries seeking economic improvements. And secondly, concerning capacity, actually this is the finding is perhaps less surprising, because countries with high capacity governments high performance, low corruption governments are doing much better in e-government than those with low capacity governments. So I thought these are three perhaps interesting articles I would like to share.
So those are great lessons and articles that you've overviewed, so thank you for that. Now, what does this mean that your research, policy and education workforces on the analysis, design, and performance of technology-enabled governance in different national, local, and sectorial contexts, and the transfer of governance mechanisms between contexts? What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a mouthful, isn't it? Yes, absolutely. Thank you for this question. I mean, that's essentially, I define my research interest currently along these lines, and the rationale is that the performance of public sector technology, so electronic governance, for example, performance in terms of effectiveness of public service delivery, or effectiveness of engaging citizens, or how well we can do in terms of simplifying administration and administrative burden, the performance of these depends on many external factors that are beyond the design of the initiatives themselves. So factors having to do with legal, institutional, economic, social, and other aspects of the environment where we deploy electronic governance initiatives, whether we talk about national, local, or sectorial environment. So on the one hand, we are interested in adapting government digitization efforts to specific local or sectorial contexts, because in this way we can deliver more targeted and effective responses to context-specific circumstances and needs. So whether we want to pursue government digitization in Denmark will be different, very different than if we do this in, say, Afghanistan, yes? Or if we do this in education sector, will be quite different if we do this in security or tourism. So we need to take context into account. But on the other hand, we would like to know how such context can positively or negatively influence the performance and ultimately the success of such efforts, and how to design such initiatives to match contextual needs. And so, and this is related also to how to successfully transfer such initiatives between contexts. And when I talk about initiative, I mean more than just the development of technical development of computer systems. It's also the re-engineering, the redesign of processes, the education capacity building of civil servants who will be operating these systems, and the legal foundations for delivery of such systems, etc. So if we go beyond just technological development, then there are a lot of factors that play into the importance of taking context into account. That's the my research interest at the moment.
You know, you do some really fascinating work that's going to be and is of use to so many governments around the world, and to ensure the UN goals are met as well. I also find of interest that you have a number of organizations funding your work, such as the Macau Foundation, the World Bank, UNDP, European Commission, Commonwealth Secretariat, and several national governments, Microsoft, and so on. How did that come about? Why are they funding your work?
Well, there are various reasons for this. All of these partnership is based on specific projects or programs that we have been running with these organizations, funded by these organizations, and sometimes in cooperation, also in technical cooperation with these organizations. So for example, Macau Foundation was a key partner for us to run eMacau program, which is an electronic government program that we have been carrying out for close to a decade in Macau, in support of Macau government, but also transferring outcomes of this program to many developing countries. Macau Foundation was and remains critical also a partner in supporting the ISGOV conference series. World Bank, we partner with World Bank on the development of electronic government strategy for Afghanistan, together with the Afghan Ministry of ICT. Microsoft, this is a research on semantic interoperability and electronic governance, so how to pursue the development of systems that can, in a meaningful way, exchange information across administrative and institutional boundaries, understanding each other, not only being able to technically interoperate, but also interoperate on the level of semantics. European Commission, that's another case. We've done two projects funded by EC. One is evaluating the performance of e-government training in China, and another one, more recent, is building a global research and policy community on e-government and policy modeling. The project is called EGOV Polynet. It recently completed. It was coordinated by Maria Wimmer from University of Koblenz, and had something about 17 partners from different countries. Commonwealth Secretariat is the recent partner that funded our work, or co-funded the work, on mobile governance. We performed mobile governance research, so how mobile technologies can support the government organizations, particularly in small island developing states that often comprise difficult geographical situations. Here we took the case of the country of Vanuatu in South Pacific, where we developed a mobile governance strategy, and on this basis came up a mobile governance toolkit through which different countries, small island developing states, but not only, can come up with their own custom-made mobile governance strategies to maximize the potential of mobile technologies for public policy and development.
So what are some of the key projects and wins from the past and into the future, including for 2015 and into 2016? And then what is the value to the stakeholders? Now, I know you've covered some of this, but if you can get into more detail.
Yes, we're currently commencing two projects of that will transfer from 2015 to 16. One is, and all of them have this component of context-specific development of electronic governance. So one is EGOV for administrative burden reduction. So we look at how electronic governance can support government efforts in reducing the burden, reporting burden on citizens, on businesses, on public administration itself, through a variety of strategies like personalization, digital by default, once-only principle, and others. And the second project is EGOV for context-specific public service delivery. So here we look at how we can deploy public sector ICT to maximize the efficiency of public service delivery in different local, sectoral, and national contexts, and how context actually can be taken into account. We are also completing a Smart City for Sustainable Development project with International Development Research Center, IDRC, which is a Canadian research funding research center. And we would also like to continue onward this project into 2016. In all three cases, the main value for the stakeholders is establishing the state of the art and policy alternatives in the related areas. So what we know about the area in terms of EGOV and administrative burden reduction, context-specific public service delivery, or smart city and sustainable development, and what policy alternatives exist in front of policymakers, and how to decide them. So essentially, how to define a research agenda through which policymakers can make informed choices considering the specificity of the context, national, local, or sectoral. We also, through this project, delivering pilots that are validating the findings. And once validated, also the courseware for policymakers as added value.
Now, there's a number of executive forums out there. In fact, I've been part of them, and I was chairing a session for the European Union CIO of the Year winners, but two of them came from the public sector as one example. And then last year, I was the vice chair at the World CIO Forum held in China and hosted or produced by IFIP, this International Federation for Information Processing. So there's a lot of curiosity in my audience who are senior executives. So how do you view CIO governance challenges, and how can they be addressed?
Well, I will talk about what I know about, which is the role of CIO for enhancing public governance. So public sector CIO is my main, our main interest. Rather than the private sector CIOs. And I do know that the two worlds are somehow intersecting, but also very different. So government CIO has a rather different set of challenges that private sector CIOs. So for the public sector CIO, we're particularly interested in supporting the mandate of government organizations working individually together across the whole of government or across sectoral or international boundaries through digital technology, and how a government CIO can get so supporting the mandate through digital technology, meaning mandate comes first, technology comes second, and getting the most out of technology and potentially expanding the objectives. So being able to also actively pursue innovation and how government organizations can do better, can do more with digital technology. Again, the performance is not for its own sake or for government alone, but ultimately for citizens and local communities for supporting public policy and development. So that's the ultimate challenge and value that, in our view, the public sector ICT should serve. The challenge for public sector CIOs is the need to experiment versus to get the value, most value out of ICT versus the traditional risk aversion typical for government organizations. So this we see as a major challenge, because particularly in the public sector, people much prefer to play this very safe, and therefore innovation is much harder to come by in the public than in the private sector. The second challenge is, say, changing political priorities versus agenda versus changing technological, shifting all the time technological landscape, and versus long-term programming and mission required from government organizations. So this to me is a balance always that a public sector CIO would have to find and struggle with. And knowing very well that the job goes well beyond technical or technological concerns, and even beyond organizational concerns, beyond the needs of one's own organization, because this organization does not stand on its own, but it's part of a larger government environment. So my first take at addressing these and other challenges is basically institutionalization of public sector technology. So the process that has commenced, or mainstreaming of public sector ICT, so or you can say this forgetting about E in front of e-government, because it becomes so much part of the government work that there's no need to talk about technology in a special way anymore. Plus, institutionalization of the government CIO positions themselves. There are many efforts around the world in seeking to emulate the success of government CIO offices from around the world, from countries like US and UK, Singapore, even Korea. But every environment will have its own specificity, and there is a need for adaptation.
You know, it's interesting. At one of the conferences, I was approached by a number of governments, and they weren't early stage sort of developing nations. I would say mid stage developing nations, and they're very much interested in some kind of repository, a CIO governance repository of ways to do CIO governance, and they were looking for sources of information which they could sort of adopt and look at. Do you have a recommendation there?
Well, there are established government CIO systems that are have been operating with success for some time, and are often willing to share the lessons of success. I mean, some of the very open systems I know about is, for example, Estonia, and that has a specific dissemination platform called the e-governance academy. Another is Singapore, and there is a corresponding dissemination platform called Infocom Development Authority International. Infocom Development Authority is like a government CIO office for the government of Singapore. And of course, looking at the experience of from the U.S. itself, with its extensive legal support for the performance of the government CIO function, and the CIO university. But having said this, I think your question touches on a real problem, because we do not really have an international repository. And we don't even have the, I would say, internationally transferable education programs for government CIOs. Most of the education in this area is not formal, and or performed within the national civil service systems, perhaps with support from universities. So there is a problem because there is so much need for exchange of knowledge, experience, and for creating these peer-to-peer communities of government CIOs that can learn from each other. So I would say beyond this, I would watch for increasing research and policy publications in this area, for example, published in Government Information Quarterly or in the ISGOV conference series. And there are also magazines I know that are wholly dedicated to public sector CIOs that and freely available online. I would say these are the best sources I can think about. But I also would point out at the noticeable lack of formal education in this area to offer an international curriculum.
So do you see the UN providing this function at some point, perhaps through the programs that you're already in, part of?
It's a good question, because UN, particularly due to the United Nations e-government survey run from the UNDESA, United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs, would be clearly a good platform for promoting the such a repository. There is a public administration, UNPAN, public administration network that could perhaps serve this purpose, but it's not specific to the government CIO function. So that is certainly an interesting possible host of advisory services and education programs that could be deployed for the needs of government CIOs. We have been talking with UNDESA for some time, and perhaps we might have some interesting resolution. This important instrument is coming up every 2 years right now. Last edition was in 2014. Perhaps along with the 2016 edition, a repository function might be re-examined to support governments in improving their performance in the ranking.
So this next question is a little bit broader in scope, in that what do you see as the key issues with the ICT sector itself, and particularly computing, and then what are your recommendations?
If you don't mind, I will narrow down to public sector ICT or e-government. And the key issue here is that technology alone cannot deliver. So technology has to be accompanied by organizational and more often inter-organizational change, which unfortunately also makes every technological intervention somehow specific, unique, and difficult to transfer from one context to another, one organizational context to another organizational context, or one socio-economic context to another. So that's a challenge to me, and it's also an argument for the need to blend our approach with the technology and management aspect coming together. Another challenge is that technology alone is value neutral. So it can be used for both positive and negative ends. See the discussion and the paper I mentioned earlier about the performance of democratic versus non-democratic countries in electronic government. But we should be aware that only the usage of technology, and particularly the political context in which this usage takes place, assigns value of technology. So we beyond, of course, an optimistic and completely optimistic view of technology, and have to look at the political context to look at the issues of value. Another challenge to me is how more and more technological knowledge is diffused across different sectors and intersects with domain knowledge, and how difficult and increasingly difficult it will be for us to keep these two sources of knowledge separate, and also to educate technology and domain professionals separately. These I see like three example challenges for ICT sector, public sector ICT.
And again, another sort of broader question, do you feel that computing should be a recognized profession on par with maybe something like accounting, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials?
The short answer is yes, absolutely. Longer answer is that, again, it will be more and more difficult for us to neatly separate technological and non-technological domains and knowledge. So, for example, technological and legal knowledge, or technological and medical knowledge. So more and more, this we will have to somehow find ways to bring these together and educate and train professionals, hybrid professionals who are who know about legal aspects of technology or the technology in health or education domains. Second answer is that we should also beware what are the boundaries between computing as a profession and computing as a technical skill, and recognize both. So we need both, and we need to see the boundary of where a university degree is required to perform computing jobs, and where a technical degree is perhaps sufficient. So yes, that would be my, and I completely agree with you concerning professional development and quality issues that have to be addressed very much for computing profession.
You know, that's a pretty sort of insightful answer that you gave to my last question. So I'm not sure if this question here really applies, because I think you've covered it, but I'm going to ask it anyways. So, you know, from the previous question, can you expand on ICT professionalism and your recommendations?
So here, perhaps I would refer specifically to the government CIO profession, which is a hybrid of technology management and public policy expert. So for this type of specialized ICT profession, we do need formal education and do need this on the international level. So that's what I commented earlier when talking about the scarcity of peer-to-peer support crossing international boundaries, and also formal education for government CIOs. So ICT is global, every government needs ICT, and increasingly governments have to just work together to resolve common regional global problems, and all of these require the use of ICT. So ICT profession and government CIO profession has to be delivered on the international level so that people speak the same language. Not only the natural language, but also technological language.
And this next question sort of continues in this vein, and it's about ethics and your recommendations.
Absolutely. I mean, integrity, professionalism, respect for diversity, etc. I mean, no question, a foundation. There is just too much responsibility in the hands of ICT professionals and GCIO executives in particular to come without a value system on which we educating people. The responsibility, the influence that people hold is such that the training in ethics and common system of values is critical.
And then what other areas particularly related to computing do you feel need to be brought into focus for discussion and policy?
I feel one area I'd like to perhaps notice is personalization and proactive public service delivery. For the delivery of public services, electronic public services, this is a major issue in my view. because of rising citizen expectations and increasing pressure on governments to cut on the costs. So a lot of weight is on very intelligent way of responding to the needs of citizens in terms of public service delivery, knowing what public services a citizen needs, when he or she needs them, and how he or she would like to receive them, and providing them in a proactive way, so without being asked. So knowing about the circumstances of citizens, and from these circumstances, being able to deduce what kind of public services one needs.
You know, you've had a number of successes throughout your life, and you've made tremendous contributions to the sort of the global domain. Are there any stories that you can share, perhaps, of impossible challenges you were able to master, and perhaps lessons you've learned from those challenges?
I think my main impossible challenge, as you call it, is switching from very technical computer science background. My PhD was on the topic of fault tolerance, so how to build reliable systems from unreliable components, and more specifically, how we can formally specify and reason about fault tolerance as a property of computer systems. So a fairly technical and focus. And my impossible challenge was how to switch to e-government. So to e-government, becoming e-government researcher, policy expert, and practitioner. So that was a process that took me some years and has been professionally both rewarding and challenging experience. But I believe it's possible. And maybe the second impossible challenge is the conference that I already referred to. This has been also an effort in developing a new successful conference series in a very dense and competitive world of eGov research conferences. This is also a challenge that I consider as one of more important ones to my professional career, although it does not add in terms of my academic career and certainly draws a lot of time away from research and policy work to more mundane organizational work, and yet it's a service to the community that I consider important. But it has been challenged because it's a competitive area and it's difficult to sustain conferences because people have a lot of conferences to choose from, and because normally the research and policy worlds do not easily intersect.
Now, are there any lessons that you want to share based on these impossible challenges?
Yes. The first one, the transition from technical expert to policy expert has been, to me personally, a stretch assignment, which I think in the leadership literature is well known. So I have been thrown into deep water at one moment in my career in having to manage an e-government project with 44 government organizations without having a prior experience in the area of electronic government. And at that time, it was 2004, nobody really had much of an experience. So that has been transformative to me in terms of trying to keep my head above the water all the time or looking wise and competent on questions that I was not really wise or very competent about, but also having an opportunity of learning in the process. So that was definitely a really changing experience to me. And another important lesson to me, and I will go back to your question about ethics. So I would, defining value that one wants to deliver to customers, to stakeholders, in my case, to e-government researchers and policymakers. Because ISGOV, in some way, the conference series have been based not just on performing specific organizational functions, but also upon certain values. And then delivering this value and in the process aiming at the highest quality you can achieve. And in the process also taking care of your network. So I would say these are the stretch assignment, taking care of the value proposition and taking care of your network are three important lessons. Not the only ones, but important lessons I can think of now.
Now, in your current role, what are some of the top resources and lessons that you can share with the audience?
Well, I will not be very innovative here. I will point to the Government Information Quarterly as the leading source of information on information technology governance and policy, authoritative, relevant, both relevant and authoritative. And rigorous. So this is a very important combination where academic world delivers rigor, policy world delivers relevance, and GIQ can excel in both, and I warmly recommend it. ISGOV will be an interesting resource for all who would like to learn about the latest developments in information technology for governance, particularly in the development context, with a lot of news happening around the world that we normally don't just know about. And going beyond e-government, one of my favorites is EconTalk, the Library of Economic Celebrities, which delivers very important insight. So this is econtalk.org. This delivers very important insight on the weekly basis. This is hosted by Russ Roberts, and it delivers weekly reviews, discussions with authors of important research, important policy work in economy in general, but also intersection of economy and technology. I warmly recommend it.
Because you sit at the intersection of so much, do you have any sort of predictions you want to make for the future?
I will follow up, and that's of course another recommendation for the source is of course The Economist. There was a few weeks back, there was a special issue of The Economist on on-demand economy. And this I warmly recommend to have a look. And based on this, my prediction will be an observation also around is further growth of the on-demand economy with all its advantages, so flexibility for employees and cost for employers and for customers, and also dangers, so social security, for employees and quality for employers and customers. I would also see a similar trend taking place in the public sector with the on-demand or just-in-time civil service increasingly being used in the public sector to deliver specialized competencies at the time at in the place where they are needed. So that's certainly a prediction I would like to bet in the future.
You know, there's tidal waves. I call them digital quakes that occur, and it helps to shape government and culture and social progress and so much. The internet would be one. Mobile computing could be another as examples, which were somewhat anticipated, but not fully, and you could see how it's changed, the development of the WSIS action sort of discussions that occur in Geneva or even the Millennium Development Goals or the Sustainable Development Goals, and how it's helped to shape some of that. as they're being actioned. So what about the sharing economy and its impact? And that's evidenced by things like Airbnb and Uber and so much more. And the other one, which you're starting to see a lot in the press, is deep learning. And that is this rising use of machine learning and its implications, because who knows how it will shape economies and culture and science and business and industry and also governments. What about those, the impact of those, and do you see any discussions about that at all?
Yeah, I mean, there is, of course, tremendous amount of discussion on the trends you mentioned, plus, of course, mobile, big data, data analytics. A very interesting publication came up recently from Deloitte on GOV 2020. A journey into the future of government, and that talks about a number of drivers of change and mega shifts that are really worth paying attention to. And going onward from the ones that you mentioned, for cloud computing, it's interesting to see the impact of these for equitable development, how cloud computing can make different the equally high quality public services in different for different territorial by different territorial governments, and going beyond the seeing government increasingly not as an implementer or service provider but enabler. Orchestrator, so the what we call government as a platform or lean government, how governments clearly cannot do this alone because of various reasons, economic reasons, because of the magnitude of challenges they have to deal with and complexity, and sometimes because of lack of legitimacy. So engagement of non-state actors, private sector, civil society, even citizens themselves, with government playing an orchestrating and guiding role is very important. And all of this clearly would not be possible without technology. So this is a trend that we will see more and more happening in the future, along with the what we call distributed governance, yes? So major governance functions being, or self-governance functions being performed increasingly on the local level, based on smart data and decisions made on local big smart data. So yes, I feel it's very important to look at the trends, and but not to jump into territories where we didn't learn enough. So there are limits of risks one can take, particularly in the public sector, with new untested technology. So there is a need, a process for these technologies to mature before it's fully adopted. But there is also clearly a need for experimentation and some risk-taking.
So how can people in the audience who are primarily executives, how can they act on your predictions?
Well, if we talk about, say, on-demand economy, I feel the acting on predictions means two things in terms of hiring decisions, which increasingly will have to take on-demand economy into account. There are some jobs that is difficult to perform online, but of course ICT industry is one when one can do this online. But then there is an issue of embedding of technological solutions in enterprise context where that are not so easy to say perform without knowledge of the local context. And the second, acting on prediction, the second aspect is the opportunities for software development that powers the on-demand economy, because clearly there is no on-demand economy could happen without platforms, software platforms that make it possible. So I foresee that there will be, of course, more opportunities to work with the public sector and more of the public money being spent by the private sector companies and being able also to engage in innovation, in transferring of innovation from the private to the public sector and perhaps back.
Thomas, you're a tremendously successful and notable internationally recognized executive and researcher. And as a result, you had to implement and utilize different leadership kind of skills. So what are your best leadership lessons that can be used by the audience?
Well, of course, thank you very much for your kind words. There are many different leadership styles, and these styles will be also variably suited to different types of organizations. So being fully aware of this, and not only to different organizations, but in different stages of the development of these organizations. So my lesson in leadership is refers back to value system. So my main lesson is not to ignore the value system upon which one would like to build his organization or his her organization. And defining this value system, looking for people who share these values and educate and empower young people, both in technical and managerial skills and in values. It's much easier to learn technical and managerial skills than to change the value systems. One can say even it's impossible to change a value system in a shaped, mature individual. It's important for leaders to take this educational role and make young people aware about the importance of keeping the work and life balance, and that it's not worth to pursue career at all costs. So that there are boundaries, there are limits, and healthy balance is very important, not only for personal development, but also for career development as well. You may want to ask whether I apply this principle, and I will probably ask for another question.
And you have a good sense of humor as well. So, now, Thomas, you have many interests. Are there any that you want to share and maybe talk about briefly?
Maybe just very briefly. Travel will be my interest, and I travel a lot. But for some years right now, I have been unable to separate my traveling from business trips. So somehow I have been unable to fully appreciate traveling for pleasure and discovering new places. So I've been in some interesting places, but not really having to combine this with business responsibilities. I hope to be able to separate this in the future and just enjoy traveling for its own sake.
Well, Thomas, you've shared so much, and I know your schedule is demanding, and wow, you do everything. And you have this host of wisdom and experience that you brought to this interview. So thank you for sharing so much with our audience.
Stephen, thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you very much for your interesting questions. And I look forward to perhaps hearing from you later.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Thomas Yonowski, top international governance authority, and founding head of the United Nations University Operating Unit on Policy-Driven Electronic Governance.